Monster Man, special episode, The Monsters of Marlinco.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers. And in particular, of Patreon backer Katie. If you'd like to be like Katie and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get the rewards for lower levels, including all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities, which is all about the deities and demigods book and real-world mythology and religion and how to use them in your fantasy role-playing games. Katie has requested today's episode because her husband is about to start running a game set in Chris Kutalik's, is it the Hill Cantons? Is that the name of the setting? And specifically, the setting of his book, Fever Dreaming Marlinco. Now, it turns out that I have a copy of Fever Dreaming Marlinco, and it further turns out that I've never actually read it all the way through. So this was a great opportunity to finally sit down and read a book about which I've heard nothing but good things. All right, first part, the premise. So Marlinco is a town divided into four districts, or contradas, each of which has its own very distinct personality. One of the things that I like about it is that the four district personalities, as it were, the kind of characters of the four regions, aren't just what you would expect from what they are. So for example, the overall attitude of the sort of noble district is actually that they're kind of depressed and they have a little bit of an inferiority complex toward the other districts. This is connected to the big local festival, the Ebon Horse Fair, a chariot race between the four contradas. This seems like it's inspired by the rites surrounding the sacrifice of the October horse in ancient Rome. This was a ritual chariot race that was followed by the sacrifice of one of the winning horses. And other events too, like ritual fights between different districts of the city. In Marlinco, the thing that dies in the race is not the animal, but the charioteer. And the charioteers are all condemned criminals, and it's the losers who are executed rather than the winner. But I think the influence is there. Marlinco is a city that is on the edge of civilization, kind of the boundary where towns and cities are on one side, and then the wilderness, and the sort of magical, weird wilderness is on the other. So it's kind of a liminal space, literally, I suppose, in that it's a border region. And the more magical weirdness the city encounters, the more kind of bizarre and irrational it becomes. So initially, when you encounter Marlinco, if you encounter it at a relatively low score on what they call the Chaos Index, you're going to see the locals obsessed with squabbles over money and status and so on. But then, once the Chaos Index starts climbing, they start getting onto the weird stuff. I should say, of course, that the, like, weird area near Marlinco is the subject of another book by the same author, Slumbering Ursine Dunes. Part 2. But James, what about the monsters? Well, you noticed that, did you? Yeah, there's not actually too many monsters in Marlinco per se. Well, there aren't too many new types of monsters, and this being your kind of urban environment, the majority of your encounters are actually going to be with what we might call antagonists or villains, as opposed to monsters. You know, more or less humans. But there are a couple of sort of dungeony spaces within the city, and there are a couple of opportunities for you to run up against a supernatural creature. Even within the dungeons, there are a comparatively small number of monsters in here that are unique to Marlinco. Instead, it's the context within which these monsters appear that makes them stand out. Now, I'll give you an example. Oh, I should say that this whole episode contains spoilers for Fever Dreaming Marlinco, so if you're planning on playing it and you don't want to know what the nasty underside of the city is like, I hope that you will enjoy Tuesday's episode. One of the main antagonists of Fever Dreaming Marlinco is Lady Suzera. And she is she's what's called a Strigoi, which is not to put too fine a point on it, a vampire, although we'll more about that in a moment. And let's say you wind up exploring her manor. One of the encounters you might have is two zombie maids cleaning up something that she has smashed in one of her, like, tantrums. And the description goes out of its way to, like, point out that the maids are rotting corpses whose bloating bodies are straining to break free of their tight uniforms. So you start to realize, like, oh, you know, Lady Scissor's maids are kind of wearing, like, teehee maid uniforms, you know? And this is, so there are three things about this. First, it's revolting, which is obviously the key point. With zombies, you know, zombies are one of those things where the fundamental concept of the monster is really horrific, but we're very deadened to it by constant exposure, right? We see zombies a lot in the media. And consequently, if you're going to have a memorable zombie encounter, you need to, as I frequently say, zhuzh it up a little bit. And this is a good example of how to do that. The contrast between the sort of presumed slightly naughty comic titillation of the maid outfit and the horror of, you know, the decomposing body. And these sort of both are on like that body axis, if that makes sense. That's really good. It's revolting, but it's revolting in a specific and memorable way. This is something you do get a lot in zombie movies. I feel like makeup effects artists love to create individual zombies who are kind of memorable just because of the way in which they specifically express core zombie concepts. Secondly, it tells you a little something about Lady Suzera, that she's the kind of person who would put her maids in little chi-chi maid outfits, even though they are rotting corpses, and also that she smashes things in fits of pique, which, you know, is an insight into her personality. And third, I mean, the key point here is that these are just, at a mechanical level, these are just zombies, regular old zombies. And so this encounter becomes memorable, not because of the unique qualities of the monster, but just because of the care and thought that's gone into presenting it. Now, here's a question. Designers that you like, do they sit down and consider these matters and, you know, present the monster with care given to these principles? Or do they just have a vibe that works for them? I'm not saying that that's like one is skilled and the other not, you know, learned skills that are incorporated into the way that you write just kind of feel natural to you. You put stuff into things without really consciously thinking about it. Now, I said that Marlenko has very few kind of novel monsters. That is not to say that it has none. It does have a few. Of the monsters in the book's bestiary section, I think my favorite is the Wobbly Giant. In fact, one of the things that really enchanted me about the Wobbly Giant is that it is not called the Wobbly Giant. It's called the Giant, Wobbly. And as you'll know, if you've listened to Monster Man before, we love it when a monster is a something, something else. So the Giant, Wobbly. The Giant, Wobbly is a giant sort of defender of the working class. And it reminds me a little bit of the effigies that were sort of like pushed around the street in big carts during sort of communal celebrations. I associate this with like the 18th century, the sort of like almost organized rioting in places like Boston, where different districts would have these sort of like effigies or dummies that you had to kind of like compete to capture. Anyway, it's invoked by members of a particular guild. They kind of have like the right that they can summon it. And because of that, it strikes terror into the hearts of anyone who has more than 10,000 gold pieces, which I thought was a very funny, it's kind of a, it's a real counterpoint to the recently discussed Ouroboros, right? Which preys on people who have lots of money because it also wants the money. But if you have more than 10,000 gold pieces and you see the Wobbly Giant on the rampage, you realize that actually it might have your name and number. I said that it strikes terror into the hearts of anyone with more than 10,000 gold pieces, but speaking of strikes, it also kind of broadcasts an aura of, like, work stoppage. Wheels will not turn in its presence, which is a great little piece of folklore magic, and manages to, like, be a reference to the Wobbly Giant basically being the patron of the Teamsters Union, while also sounding like something that might be in a folk tale someone's great-grandmother would tell. The giant can be invoked by members of the Guild of Condottieri, Link Boys, Roustabouts, and Stevedores. If you don't know what a Link Boy was someone who would carry a torch or link around, so it's torchbearers. This was actually a service that you could hire in cities prior to the introduction of like public street lighting. Was that there would be, you know, if you were rich, obviously your own servants would carry a lamp for you. But if you weren't and you needed to go home late at night, you could just like pay a penny to a link boy and he would carry a torch around next to you so that you could find your way. So condottieri, obviously, are mercenaries. Link boys are torchbearers. And then roustabouts and stevedores, you know, people who like load and unload cargo. So these are hirelings, the kind of people that the PCs might hire in a traditional, you know, old school D&D scenario. This, I should say that Fever Dreaming Merlinko is written for Labyrinth Lord, which is a retro clone of an earlier version of D&D. I don't know which one off the top of my head. So there's a system of essentially tracking the PC's reputation with this guild. In a lot of games, there's not much in the way of consequences for killing hirelings. It'll say something like, you know, if you go off to the dungeon and you do with a bunch of hirelings and you come back without any, you will begin to get a reputation as a kind of person that's hard on hirelings. But with the idea here being, I think, that Merlinko will serve as like a long-term base for the PCs as they explore the Slumbering Ursine Dunes, we need to get a little more detailed than that. And ultimately, it may be the case that either, you know, you're so nice to the Guild of Condottieri, Link Boys, Roustabouts, and Stevedores that they are willing to summon the giant comma wobbly on your behalf, or you are so hated by them that they might even summon the giant to come and get you and you know, take revenge for their fallen comrades. And there are lots of intermediary stages. Now, so I really like this way. You know, it's simple enough to be like practical to keep track of it, but detailed enough that it has some sort of mechanical bite to it and makes you think a little bit more about your relationship with hirelings and like the community of hirelings. I mentioned before that Suzra is a Strigoi, which is a common name for vampires in a lot of Eastern Europe. I think ultimately derives from a word that means owl. I think that's right. Comes from Strix. And in fact is the origin of the name of the D&D monster, the Sturge, which is probably just a misspelling. Elsewhere in Europe, it means a witch, and that's what you get when, you know, I mean, as I've said before, the words for werewolf and vampire and witch are all mixed up in lots of different European folklores because these are not really those kinds of clearly defined monsters. And actually, there's something that I really like about the design of the Strigoi. Now, the Strigoi is basically a D&D vampire, but it has more kind of folkloric trappings to it than the more sort of Marvel Comics Dracula vampire that is the D&D vampire. And specifically, so if you kill a Strigoi, it will come back to life within a day. So there are a bunch of things that you can do to prevent it from coming back. And there are five things listed here, and they include things like driving a silver stake through its heart, cutting off its head, cutting the body into four pieces and burying each piece on the corner of a crossroads, sprinkling slivovitz on the corpse, hitting it with a rooster inside a sack. All of those things work, but you don't need to do all of them, but you do need to do more than one of them. So you have to do three of the five things. This is great. I really like it because what it allows you to do is have every like folklore know-it-all that the PCs run into give them a different method for dealing with the Strigoi. You know, if you're talking to some barroom blowhard about the Strigoi and he goes, well, what you gotta do with a Strigoi is you gotta cut its head off and then it can't come back. And then, you know, later on you're talking to some wise fortune teller and she says, to prevent the undead from returning, you must drive a silver stake through its heart or whatever. And so you can just have like all these different methods of killing it and they can all be true. I think that's really terrific. I like it when monsters that have that folkloric element, like your vampires and goblins and so forth, have a little bit of loosey-goosiness about them. That's something that we've talked about before, is how these stories often, you know, you cannot take all these many different accounts of vampires and turn them into a single rules-bound creature without losing a lot of the fun stuff about them. And like I said, I like almost any spin on the vampire better than the standard one, if for no reason other than that it's just been done. The third monster of the group is the Robo Dwarf. They are, I mean, they're just what they sound like. I do like how weird they are. They're a player character class in this supplement, but sometimes you run into like rogue ones, and it describes their war cries of binary numbers and smell of dusty primrose, which I think is just like, even in, you know, probably less than a sentence or two of description other than stuff that's just about combat in this entry, you get this sense of weirdness that you're dealing with something a bit alien. Also, their sort of sergeants have a baton of poison gas because they love poison gas because, you know, they're robots, they're immune to it, which makes a lot of sense. So the robot dwarves are fine, but I think that the real stars here are the giant comma wobbly and the Strigoi. Part three, putting it all together. So one thing I like about the monsters in this book is that they complement the main feel of the book really well. You know, so I mentioned before the idea that Merlinko is a place for adventurers. So it's a place for adventurers, but it's also the town base for adventurers who are heading out into the slumbering Ursine Dunes. And so that, you know, if we kind of take the typical D&D model of what the, like, adventuring base city is like, people are going to interact with it by visiting it at intervals. You're going to come back to Marlinko once every so often. And so this town has all these several elements that reward that approach. So, for example, the Chaos Index kind of escalates the weirdness in the town as time passes. And because you're not, like, there continuously, you will just have this series of experiences where every time you come back to Marlinko, things will have kind of escalated a little bit, and you have to kind of, like, get to know it all over again. Weirder and weirder things become likely. So you might return to Marlinko after, like, this series of mysterious disappearances has begun, which is kind of one of the things that can begin. Well, not that mysterious, but it's one of the things that can begin as the Chaos Index goes up. And that's really nice. You know, there's a tendency either to have really collapsed plot lines that happen, you know, all in a series of a couple of nights, or to make adventuring town bases rather static and not really change very much. And I feel like this threads the needle very effectively. Every time you return to Marlinko, it's changed in a way that's never completely random, but also it's not just a linear timeline. Secondly, of course, you've got the build-up toward the chariot race. We've got a festival, and you know I like it when there are festivals in role-playing games because they were such an important part of civic life, and they're not in games very often, actually. Presumably because you have to kind of, like, get the players in the right place at the right time or something like that. But here, it works because people are getting fixated on the build-up to the festival, right? It's not even necessarily the Ebon Horse Fair that really matters, but that all the tension and rivalry that develops in the, you know, weeks and months preceding the fair. So this gives us kind of overall themes of change and escalation and degeneration. And if you're doing that, then the Strigoi is a good monster for that, right? A long-lived kind of mastermind, although I don't know that Lady Scissor is necessarily a mastermind of anything. But, you know, vampires fit that kind of changing over time setting really well. The other kind of main villains in the setting are they're not like manipulating the Chaos Index, but as the Chaos Index gets higher and higher, their kind of wilder, more violent tendencies are coming to the fore. So they might seem kind of harmless, although their beliefs are weird when you meet them the first time, but then they start putting their weird beliefs into bloodier and bloodier practice, and they become bolder and more ecstatic as the general level of sort of atmospheric chaos increases. I really like that. I like that kind of feedback system. I'm tempted to have something like it in my campaign, actually, because it seems like a very straightforward way of handling kind of an overall level of magical tension. And also, it's something that the PCs can affect when they go out to adventure. The things you can do in the Slumbering Ursine Dunes that will have the effect of changing the Chaos Index. So this is a good example of what I think is a very, I mean, for want of a better word, efficient way of implementing distinctive monsters in a distinctive setting. So almost all the monsters in the sort of dungeon sections of Marlinko are bog standard monsters that you would find somewhere else, but they occur in a different context. And there are enough new monsters that the place feels a little bit different, particularly as one of those, I mean, okay, is a pretty slight variant on an existing monster type. I like that the vampire, the Canthal Strigoi, is not affected by holy symbols, but does lose a turn laughing uncontrollably if you brandish a holy symbol at it, which simultaneously makes you feel like a chump, but also gives you an opportunity to, you know, run or wallop it or something. We got a small number of distinctive feature monsters. We got a lot of regular people acting weird and regular monsters in unique and memorable contexts. And we have a system that engages those monsters with the setting in a way to create that sense of surreality that is such a feature of Slumbering Ursine Dunes in a setting where we nonetheless need to be, like, dealing with people and solving plots and, you know, having politics, which are all things that, more than the kind of, like, surreal type of OSR adventure, require you to have characters who have more, like, believable and grounded motivations. So that when you see these people starting to act weird, you will actually think, this is odd, you know, they are acting out of character. And in Marlinko, you'll be right. Something will be wrong. So just because a monster seems like one you've seen before doesn't mean that it can't be used in new and interesting ways. And it doesn't take very many little tweaks to an existing monster to give it a whole new lease on life. And if those are the only two things that you take away from Fever Dreaming Marlinko, then I think that that's pretty good, though I doubt they will be the only two. So Katie and Stan, I hope that you enjoyed today's episode, and I hope that the Marlinko game goes well. It certainly sounds like an interesting setting, and I'm going to swipe a few aspects of it for my upcoming game. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Katie, remember that all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we'll be returning to Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition, and we're going to be taking a look at some giants, specifically the Reef Giant and the Giant, Wood, Voidkin, ). I have no idea what to expect. Well, I know that the Reef Giant's going to be like a big blue fellow with a seashell buckle, but for the Wood Giant, I got nothing. I'm quite looking forward to finding out, so I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.